Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. And joining me in studio today, Kip Allen, producer and host of World Lutheran News here on Faith and Family. Sometimes our stories merge, don't they, Kip?
They do. And this is one of those instances when we actually came together on working on the same story, quite ironically, independent of each other.
Well, public policy and laws that pertain to family are very important to me when it comes to getting the word out about that on Faith and Family. And I know you cover a lot of public policy and matters of religious freedom and conscientious objection as well on World Lutheran News.
That's correct. And this is one of those instances where it happens without a vitally important issue of religious freedom coincided with the family issue as well.
Absolutely. Well, I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO. You can find out more about them on our website, kfuo.org. Look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section there. Joining us by phone today, Dr. Donna Harrison, Executive Director of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, regular guest here on Faith and Family. Dr. Harrison, welcome back.
Thank you for asking.
I appreciate your time and expertise on this matter. What we're addressing today, the recent pro-life issue. The U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan, Southern Division, recently dismissed the ACLU's suit to force Catholic hospitals to perform abortions. This is just a few days away. This was just in the last week that this happened, I believe. And the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetrician and Gynecologist, as we sometimes call APLOG, was involved in this as well. For our listeners not familiar with APLOG, what is the work of APLOG?
We're the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and we exist to provide to medical practitioners, but also to anyone who's interested, the evidence-based rationale to defend both the pregnant mother and her unborn child. So we make available what's already published in the medical literature about what abortion does to women, as well as defending the unborn child.
In my recent visit, getting to visit with many of the members of APLOG, learning a lot about them, and I think many of them referred to that they have more than one patient, that they really have the mother, their first patient, but they also have the child, their second patient as well. And I think that's a very different perspective than what we'll see of in this case here from the worldview of others in this case.
Yes, that's right. And you know, that used to be the historical approach. Most OBGYNs went into OBGYN to take care of the baby and the mom. And so most OBGYNs don't do abortions. 85% of OBGYNs don't do abortions because we know that we have two patients.
Well, the recent case, the ACLU versus Trinity Health Corporation is the case that we're looking at today that was dismissed by the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Michigan Southern Division. Who is Trinity Health Corporation? What do we know about them?
Well, Trinity Health Corporation actually operates 90 hospitals in states all across the country, and they are a Catholic organization. And so they practice according to what's called the ethical and religious directives for Catholic hospitals. That's a set of directives that is written by the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, which outlines medical care from a Catholic perspective. And even though APLOG is not Catholic, we recognize that we have to have the ability to practice according to our conscience. And where we intersect with the ERDs is that we also defend the life of the fetus, the baby, as well as protecting the life of the mother, as does the ERDs. So we intervened in this case in defense of Trinity Health because this was an important conscience issue. In this case, the ACLU was saying that because hospitals or doctors won't perform abortions, that we're threatening the lives of women, which is absolutely untrue. There is no medical reason to perform an elective abortion. And here it's really important that, Andy, that we differentiate between abortion, which is elective abortion, and procedures that are done to save the life of a mother. So the difference is that in an elective abortion, the purpose of the procedure is to produce a dead baby. Versus there are times when we have to separate the mother and the fetus in order to hopefully save both, but at least to save one. And that the procedures are different than what you do in an elective abortion, and the treatment is different than what you do in an elective abortion. They're not the same thing. And yet ACLU, in this case, wanted to hide behind this theory that abortion is something that's done to save the life of the mother. It's completely untrue. And we applaud the district court judge for recognizing that.
What is... Oh, go ahead, Kip.
Yeah, this was one of the things that really intrigued me and got me involved in this issue, was not just that the case was dismissed by the judge, but he actually slapped the ACLU down rather sternly, saying that you have no business in this case, you have no standing, and your argument that this is an urgent matter because women's health is endangered is false. This is the first time I've heard a judge actually say that, and I think it's the first time in recent history the ACLU has suffered such a profound and verbal defeat.
I agree, and it was a point of light in an otherwise pretty sobering legal situation.
What is, let's go back to the difference between elective abortion and procedures, this concept that abortion is necessary to save the life of the mother. How does the ethical and religious directives for Catholic Health address that? How does APLOG address these issues as well?
Well, we clearly differentiate between the procedures that are done when the mother is going to die if she's not separated from her fetus, and procedures that are done with the direct intent to destroy the fetus. So, for example, in a situation where a woman has membranes, or let's say an ectopic pregnancy, that's probably a better situation. You have a pregnancy that is planted outside of the uterus, so the baby is growing in the woman's tube instead of in her uterus. When that baby grows to a certain point, the tube will rupture because the woman's fallopian tubes are not made to hold the size of a baby. And there isn't any way at this point in history to get that baby into the womb to survive. It's unfeasible to do so. So we have a situation where if the baby continues to grow in the tube, the tube will rupture and the mother will die. So in those cases, we do separate the mother and the fetus. It's the point isn't to produce a dead baby. The point is to save the mother's life, because we can't save both. If we could save both, we would. And that's how we handle that. It's really a tragic situation, and we hate to ever take the life of one of our patients. And again, the point is not to take the life, but to actually allow the mother to survive. But see, in an elective abortion, the procedures are done deliberately to destroy the baby. So you have procedures done to dismember the baby, as we all have seen those videos that went around about dismembering the babies, Planned Parenthood selling fetal parts for profit. That the point there is to harvest baby parts to sell for profit, or the point is to make sure that the mother has a dead baby. And in late-term abortions, times when separating the mother and the fetus would allow for the baby to survive outside of the womb, abortionists will actually kill the baby by injecting drugs into the baby's heart to kill the baby to make sure that the baby comes out dead. And the infamous partial birth abortion procedure that most Americans know about, where the baby's partially delivered and then the skull is decompressed, the brains are sucked out, that procedure was specifically designed to produce a dead baby. So again, the purpose of an elective abortion is way different than the purpose of procedures done to save the life of a mother.
I had gotten into discussion several times with a number of pro-abortion people who point out to the fact that we as Christians will condone abortion to save the mother's life. And they say, well, aren't you being hypocritical here where you will support abortion? The argument I always made was that if it is not done, the mother is going to die, and as a result of that, so will the baby. So there is really no choice at this point. We have to save a life. This is ethically and morally what we have to do. Is this a valid argument that you perceive that the rest of us should use when we run into this argument? And it is out there, and it is used rather frequently.
It's out there. I agree with you. It's used frequently. And yes, it's a point of clarification. In fact, the term elective abortion is what we need to focus on, because the term abortion itself, without anything in front of it, has about 20 or so different medical definitions. What we need to do is specifically say what we're talking about. We're talking about elective abortions where the purpose is to destroy the life of the baby. The purpose of separating the mother and the fetus to save the life of the mother really probably ought to be more properly termed a premature parturition, because we're not out to destroy the baby. We're out to save them both if we could, but at least to save one rather than losing both by continuing the union of the mother and the fetus.
In medical practice, is there a differentiation in documenting and those different procedures?
Oh, definitely. For example, if you are trying to separate the mother and the fetus at 24 weeks, then and you need to do it emergently to save the life of the mother, you do a C-section. Baby's delivered, neonatologists are present, and in fact, there's been a recent study out of New England Journal of Medicine that showed that babies at 22 weeks gestation could survive if they were given the right care. On the other hand, if you wanted to abort a baby at that gestational age, the baby will either be given an injection to kill the baby while it's still in the mother, or the baby will be, and I'm sorry to say this, but it's true, ripped apart limb from limb in what's called a dilatation and extraction. And these things are designed not with the primary purpose to separate the mother and the baby, but with the primary purpose of delivering a dead baby. So they're conceptually different, they're physically different procedures, their intent is different. And that's what we need to repeat over and over again. The purpose of an elective abortion is to produce a dead baby.
Are you, the ethical and religious directives for Catholic Health, which is the document that that Trinity Health Corporation subscribes to, and I believe you mentioned 90 hospitals or so in the country, and I assume they all subscribe to this. Does this this directive, does it clearly identify between elective abortion and these procedures that you were describing to save the life of the mother?
Yeah, this is what it states. Abortion, that is, the directly intended termination of a pregnancy before viability or the directly intended destruction of a viable fetus is never permitted. So in the Catholic directives, they underline that abortion, and that is induced abortion, elective abortion, is the directly intended destruction of a viable fetus. And that's never permitted. And in fact, there was a large conference held about 6 or 7 years ago in Ireland, the Dublin Declaration, which had a consortium, an international consortium of OBGYNs and other specialists, which stated that the directly intended destruction of the fetus has no role. There's no medical benefit to it, and it has no role in our practice of obstetrics and gynecology.
So this is obviously a worldwide issue. This is not just an issue that sometimes we get caught up in our own little world and think this is just an issue in the United States. This is a worldwide issue.
No, you are correct. It is a worldwide issue, And the fact is that the deception involved with what abortion actually is used to push abortion on nations that actually value life. It's being used tremendously in Africa. It was used in Ireland. It was used in Poland. That argument that you have to have abortion to save a mother's life, but it's a specious argument. It's not true. Any obstetrician can separate a mother and a fetus if we need to, and we can do it quickly. We do not need to directly intend the death of the fetus. And furthermore, most abortions are not done to save the life of the mother. Most abortions are done as an attempt to solve a social problem with surgery. And it's just, it's a deception that we need to really push on and clarify why mothers and fetuses are separated and what's intent, you know, what is the intent of it and the outcome of it.
Going back to the case of ACLU versus Trinity Health Corporation, in the ACLU claimed that at least one of their members suffered harm because of the directive, and that the directive puts at least one of their members at risk of suffering similar harm in her current pregnancy. Why did the...
Go ahead. That's not what the judge found. The judge found that there was actually no real harm. It was all speculative, and it was all, we think women are going to be harmed at some point, but in fact, there was no harm.
And the judge used some rather harsh language in rebuking the ACLU, as I recall.
Yes, he did. And I think some of that has to do with the legal threshold that has to be met for what they ACLU asked for. And the ACLU did not meet that legal threshold. And I'm no legal expert. So when I read the opinion of the judge, he basically said ACLU did not meet the legal criteria, and further that the harm that they claimed was all speculative.
What does this mean? The dismissal of this suit. What does this mean for freedom of conscience when it comes to healthcare workers, healthcare providers in the United States?
Well, like I said, this to me is a point of light, because we finally have the legal profession recognizing that just because ACLU makes a claim doesn't mean that it's true. And recognizing that there are good physicians, there are good hospitals, there are people giving good medical care who value the lives of both the mother and her unborn child, and that it's not a slam dunk anymore for ACLU to come in and claim harm when no harm actually exists. So that is a great point of light. And you know, we have other conscience cases pending right now before the Supreme Court, Little Sisters of the Poor being one of them. And it's just, it's a very challenging time for people of conscience, because we may lose that freedom of conscience depending on how the Supreme Court votes.
That was my next question. What could have this potentially become had the court ruled in favor of the plaintiff?
This, meaning the ACLU case,
right. Uh-huh.
Would definitely have been appealed to the Supreme Court. And this particular claim, this claim that it threatens the woman's life to not do abortions, this is the claim that has allowed Planned Parenthood and other pro-abortion organizations to deceive basically the public about what abortion really is. Abortion is not a life-saving procedure. Abortion is a life-taking procedure, elective abortion. So this definitely would have been appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. We're just glad that the federal district judge ruled in this way.
Will this have any precedents? Do you know? Can this case be cited in other instances?
Well, I'm not a legal expert, but I would think that since it's part of the medical record and since it's a pretty important case, that it would be cited as a precedent. As a precedent that would require those who are claiming harm from not doing an abortion to look at and say, look, you can't just speculate harm. You have to actually prove harm. And the fact is, there isn't harm from treating and defending the life of both the mother and her unborn child.
Right. If it's speculative, then you have no evidence. You have nothing to stand on if you're just speculating.
And the courts in the past sometimes have said, okay, well, we'll go with this. Yeah, you're right. There might be some harm. But in this case, the judge flatly said, no, this is not permissible.
Yeah, what a refreshing decision. It was great.
Dr. Harrison, other issues or other cases we should be watching?
Well, I think the biggest thing is the cases currently before the Supreme Court right now, specifically the Hobby Lobby case. And there's, Little Sisters of the Poor. Little Sisters of the Poor is a case that sort of also encompasses a bunch of other plaintiffs, but the Little Sisters are kind of the showcase. And Little Sisters of the Poor is the case that is requiring Little Sisters to pay for abortion employees and in their health care plans. So it's a huge fence to right of conscience of all Americans. employers. So we need to be watching that case. The outcome right now with the current Supreme Court is that they would tie. That is that the four justices who are committedly pro-abortion will vote pro-abortion, and they will. And then the three justices that that look at what the law actually says and consider and uphold the Constitution will vote for the Little Sisters, because one of our fundamental rights is the right of conscience. And then there's Justice Kennedy, who could vote either way. If there is a tie, then the Little Sisters will be allowed to continue to not provide abortion. If there isn't a tie, then you know, it sets a national precedent that we no longer live in a country with religious freedom, and it could be a very difficult time for people who care about life. There's another case that's before the Supreme Court right now, and that's called the Stormans versus Wiseman case, and that's a case of the pharmacist in Washington State who was told that he will lose his license if he does not prescribe Ella, which is Ellipristal, which is it's supposed to be a emergency contraceptive, but in fact what it is a second-generation abortion drug. It's the same kind of drug as RU486. So he refused to prescribe it, and he appealed, and the appeal was taken all the way to the Supreme Court. In this case, the importance of it is that the district court that ruled last not only said that he had to prescribe it, but basically said that healthcare workers can refuse to prescribe for other reasons, like economic or, you know, logistical reasons. They can't get a truck into their pharmacy, but they cannot refuse to prescribe on the grounds of conscience. So the Stormans case is a direct attack on conscience. The difficulty is the federal district court decision will hold if there's a tie, which means that if there's a tie in the Supreme Court, that the precedent will be set that healthcare workers cannot refuse to do life-ending procedures on the basis of conscience. So that is a direct attack on the right of conscience of healthcare workers, and that's one that we are closely following. We were also party amicus on that case as well. And it's a very sobering case. And again, we're looking at fundamental changes in what this country actually is if we lose our right of conscientious objection.
How has our present situation changed since you became a physician, since you started your practice? Did you think that we would ever get to this point, Dr. Harrison?
No, I didn't, because I grew up in a nation where I knew I had freedom of conscience. This isn't Soviet Russia. This isn't Nazi Germany. It's not, you know, communist China. We all, as Americans, had the ability to say, I won't kill someone because I don't believe in it. I don't believe that I should participate in killing other people. And, you know, through the Vietnam War, you know, we all had that possibility. But now, for the first time, we have a government who is saying, you will kill at our behest because your conscience belongs to us. And I just never thought I would see this day in our country. And I think that all Americans need to wake up and understand what a incredibly important juncture we're at in our history. We have the possibility of losing what this country was founded on, and soon.
Dr. Donna Harrison, Executive Director, American Association of Pro-Life Obstetrician and Gynecologists, thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we have more to discuss today when it comes to public policy. Up next, we're going to take a look at bills in two states that come to bring us to a similar issue as well when it comes to conscientious objection and freedom of conscience in this country. We're going to talk with Dr. Michelle Critell, the American College of Pediatricians, in just a moment. You're listening to Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration in action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. My co-host in studio today, host and producer of World Lutheran News, Kip Allen. And we are talking about public policy and particularly laws and now bills that pertain to families and particularly matters of conscience. Joining us by phone now, Dr. Michelle Critella, president of the American College of Pediatricians. Dr. Critella, welcome back to Faith and Family.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Andy. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. Always enjoy our conversation. You always bring very helpful information to the table as we discuss, especially today, public policy and these bills that are being presented that really make a difference, can make a huge difference for many families. What the issue we're talking about, Simon's Law, it's a state bill that's been dubbed Simon's Law. We'll talk about that, what it is, in just a little bit. Before we get to that, it really pertains to DNR, do not resuscitate order. What is a DNR? What does that mean if that's put on, for example, a child's chart?
Okay. Basically, in the event that any patient, child or adult, goes into cardiac arrest, stops breathing, heart stops beating, basically, we could do, as physicians, anything from basic CPR all the way up through various usage of drugs and pushing fluids, invasive procedures. So in the case of what spurred Simon's Law was the case of a very disabled newborn who had a disorder called trisomy 18. And it wasn't until after the infant passed away that the mother was reviewing the medical chart and found that the medical team had actually written an order to do not resuscitate, including, which meant no CPR, no nothing, should the child stop breathing, have his heart stop.
So no intervention whatsoever.
No intervention whatsoever. So do not resuscitate means no intervention whatsoever, not even like a CPR or mouth-to-mouth, nothing, absolutely nothing. And while the College of Pediatricians as physicians recognizes that there may be situations, including with trisomy 18 infants, there may be situations in which performing something as basic as CPR would be merely prolonging death and causing more suffering. So we agree there are certain situations where CPR might not be recommended. What we are objecting to is that the parents and guardians are not informed, are not part of the discussion. This is just wrong. It's wrong.
So in the story that the situation that prompted Simon's Law, the bill in Missouri and Kansas, that prompted this, the mother was, after the death of her child, her infant, reading the chart and discovered that there was a do not resuscitate order placed on the chart, not by her.
Right, without her knowledge. It was placed without her or her husband's knowledge, the medical team. And the reason this happened is that I don't know how many hospitals, how pervasive this is, but hospitals are increasingly writing, quote-unquote, futility guidelines. They're having hospital ethics committees collaborate with physicians to draft futility guidelines for the physicians and medical personnel who work at the hospital. So, and these futility guidelines, typically rely heavily on so-called quality of life. I mean, absolutely, there are objective guidelines as well, but quality of life and generalizations get made. So therein lies the problem. The problem is with futility guidelines that do not require physicians and hospitals to confer with the guardians and the parents.
How did we get to this in healthcare? How did we get to this point that that parents don't have they don't have a choice in the matter?
Yeah, or that they're not even given consideration. Now,
right.
Again, it's we're talking about children, infants, or adults who are in seriously ill and just awful situations. So it's not as though, okay, I bring my daughter in and she just needs to be rehydrated for a bad stomach virus. Do I have to worry about her having a DNR put up? No. But to get to your question, how did we come to this point? And I think philosophically it is a natural progression from the Roe v. Wade mentality. You know, if children have no value before birth, who do you dehumanize next? You dehumanize infants who are less than perfect. You dehumanize children and adults who are less than perfect, who are disabled. And on top of that mentality, we also have the whole financial crisis in medicine in terms of costs, you know, cost savings. You know, we can't give everybody the same costly medical care. You know, we have to watch the bottom dollar. Well, you didn't have that so much when the doctor-patient relationship was at that individual level. But now, you know, insurance companies got bigger, and now government's getting more involved. And so it just snowballs. There's this whole medicine went from being philosophically and practically, it went from being a vocation and a relationship between the physician and patient to being a business. And we got to watch the bottom line. In my own, I graduated, excuse me, in 1990, and just between graduating in 1990 and practicing, and I want to say, within the first 10 years, I saw a change in the language from patients to clients.
That's interesting.
It was. And I resisted it. But medicine got transformed philosophically first. It was sort of transformed from a vocation of service, very noble, to, oh, well, we're a business. And, you know, they are our clients. It's so many different factors, some of them philosophical and others certainly financial, big government, big pharma, big insurance companies, all those factors combined have led to sort of this dehumanizing of our most vulnerable patients and to a sort of callous approach or disparaging approach toward parents and guardians.
How did that affect you in this change in just in language alone, in the terminology that we use and other influences? How did that affect you as a practicing physician, as a pediatrician?
Well, it's interesting. I'm sorry. I have a frog in my throat. But I was in training, in my training, in 1994, the end of my first year out from medical school, was responsible for premature infants in the neonatal intensive care unit. And I always considered myself pro-life. And yet I got sucked into this mentality of, you know, we have to, of course, these preemie babies they have human dignity, but, you know, once they code or stop breathing once they do that a couple times, well, you know, their brains have been without oxygen for a certain amount of time, a couple times like that. They're just not, their quality of life is just not going to be so good. We should encourage parents to really consider putting a DNR on the chart. So this one little girl in particular, I will never forget her. Her name was Nicole. She was born at 24 weeks after conception, so just a little bit more than halfway through the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And at that time, so 24 weeks post-conception, she had a 25% chance of survival. And she encountered very typical complications that were severe consequences to her lungs, to her digestive tract, and she had gone into cardiac arrest at least two separate times within the course of 2 weeks, and the medical team really was strongly encouraging the mother to place the DNR on the chart. And the reason was, you know, her CAT scan, the CAT scan of her brain really looks like she was deprived of oxygen and maybe even might have had a stroke at some point during the resuscitation. She's just not, even if she does make it the next couple months, she would have to be in the ICU for another couple months. Even if she does make it, she's not going to have good quality of life. And what was also said behind the scenes, just when we were alone, the medical team was alone, the mother was criticized because she was being at least verbally abused by her husband, who was also a known alcoholic. And I can remember, and it brings me great shame, but I can remember that the third time little Nicole went into cardiac arrest and we, the team, resuscitated her, I can remember giving report to the next resident who came on saying, oh, and Nicole tried to die again and the stupid mother still won't put a DNR on her chart. Mm-hmm. And here, and I'm just, chills go down for me to recount this because I've been a pro-life activist since age 12 and here I was just another, like, 15 years later, and now I have this callous attitude. So if it can happen to me, it could happen to anyone. Okay. Nicole, I left her care, and I had no idea what happened to Nicole. 2 years later, still in training, but this time in an orthopedic clinic, I walked into the orthopedic office, and this two-year-old little girl with curly blonde banana curls, bright blue eyes, and a bright periwinkle blue dress with lace came running over to me, glommed onto my legs. I mean, she didn't know me, but, and I looked up to see who the mother was, and I was shocked. My jaw hit the floor. It was Nicole's mother. I looked down at her, and the mother was all excited to see me and said, look, Dr. Cretello, look at her. The only thing that she has suffered is that she didn't walk until she was 18 months old, and this is going to be her last visit here at the orthopedic clinic, and the only scar she has on her body is right here in the palm of her hand, and it doesn't even show.
Wow.
And I just was, in that moment, was so convicted by God. Oh, my gosh. And I was, I mean, thank God he blessed me with that experience just to show me, well, Michelle, you're not the one in control. You don't know what someone's future is. And, you know, so when it comes to a child who is severely ill or any individual who is severely disabled and ill, their family, that is something that should be between. Yes, we physicians have to share our knowledge with them and we guide them, but this is a decision between the family and God, and we don't know. We're not in control. We don't know the future. And that personal experience really drove it home for me.
What a certainly a remarkable experience to witness that. Yeah,
absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
I have got a question for you, Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand why the parent might put a DNR on this, and I can also understand why the physicians might recommend to the parents that this be a DNR case. But how can they put a DNR on it without the patients, without the parents' knowledge and consent? And could it be possible that a patient or a parent could demand to review a chart prior to something like this, see the DNR and say, remove it?
I think, I see where you're going. I think what parents need to do is when they're, if they have a vulnerable child, they need to ask the hospital physician, they need to ask their medical team, does your hospital have a futility policy that would allow you to put a DNR on my child's chart without my knowledge? In other words, I mean, at this point, I'm not aware of a listing anywhere that says, you know, these particular hospitals have futility guidelines that do not require parental consent.
I can't conceive of that being legal.
I know.
The state...
And yet we, you know, here we have in Missouri and Kansas, we have the need for this bill to move forward. It does not seem ethical. It does not seem ethical at all, and yet this is the point we've gotten to.
With just about a minute left, where does this proposed bill for Simon's Law stand in Missouri and Kansas? Where does it stand now? What may it bring about?
I do not know exactly where the laws are in the legislature, but the goal of the law is simply to enshrine the right of parents and guardians of vulnerable patients to be involved in the medical decision-making. At the same time, there are rare cases in which a family and medical team would disagree, meaning the family would want aggressive resuscitation, but that aggressive resuscitation would only result in prolongation of death. The bills actually have sort of a prevent that from happening in the sense in those rare situations, the parent or the guardian would be entitled to get another medical opinion, and if they found a medical opinion who agreed with them and a physician and wanted to transfer care, they could do that. But if there were basically two medical opinions who there was a consensus that, yes, this is a truly futile situation, and it would be cruel to resuscitate, we simply have to let the, you know, let the child or the patient not prolong death, let them pass. So there is, because some hospitals or physicians are concerned that they would be required to perform really excessive, extraordinary measures. And so these bills take that into account. The bills are simply looking to ensure that parents and guardians are made aware that do not resuscitate orders do not go on their loved ones' charts without the parents and guardians being informed and having a chance to participate in whether or not it gets placed on the chart.
Simon's Law, it's been dubbed. Dr. Michelle Critella, President, American College of Pediatricians, thank you for being our guest today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm Andy Bates.
Kip Ellen.
And that does it for Faith and Family today. And more family and family law, public policy coming up later on this week as well. We're going to take another look at what's going on here in Missouri. So we talk with Senator Kurt Schaefer here in Missouri. You're listening to Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.
Share-a-thon 2016 just behind us, and here to share with us a follow-up from that, Joni Harwell and Mary Schmidt, and Kip is hanging out in studio with us as well.
Yeah.
I didn't call you Mary Harwell or Joni Schmidt this time. So.
It would have worked.
Share-a-thon 2016 this past weekend, what a time, man.
Fabulous. We had a great time. We ended up with a great number on Saturday. We had over $150,000 that we had received in pledges and gifts. One gift especially from Mount Hope Lutheran Church, which has disbanded in Shelbyville, Missouri, a gift of $60,000, which is a real blessing. But every gift is a blessing to us and to our Share-a-thon, because every gift God multiplies and helps us share the good news of Jesus Christ around the world.
You're right. The Saturday was, it was kind of fast-paced. We weren't here on Sunday.
No, we weren't.
Mark was here. Saturday was the last day. Yes, it was very fast-paced. And then when the Nice family, the Ware family, came down from Shelbyville to share with us about that, what a witness to the faithfulness that God has given the folks who were a part of that congregation. I mean, they recognized that as their community got smaller, their congregation got smaller as well. And yet, as the congregation prepared to dissolve, they knew that the Lord had blessed them with gifts, and they still wanted to support the proclamation of the gospel.
And that is correct.
And they chose, they decided to take those remaining assets and use those to bless other ministries that would proclaim the good news of Jesus. And they chose KFUO to be one of those, to support the proclamation of the gospel. And even though the congregation is dissolved, they're still supporting that proclamation of the good news of Jesus.
Absolutely. That was the main thing that we wanted them to remember also, that in giving this gift, they are continuing to share the good news. They have, as you said, as the congregation has dissolved, they have moved on to various congregations, but the word is still being proclaimed, and through these gifts, it's mightily being proclaimed through KFUO.
Now, Mary, you are on the phone a lot and typing in, keeping numbers up during Share-a-thon, keeping us updated on the numbers. I've referred to Share-a-thon as kind of like a family reunion because of all the guests that come in to be here for Share-a-thon. But you get to talk to so many folks. You and Joni and Jenny get to talk with folks on the phone. Is it kind of like a family reunion in that sense? You're talking with all these supporters of Worldwide KFUO who you keep in touch with throughout the year.
It is. It is. We have a lot of people who have been giving to us throughout the years, and they're very faithful supporters, and we greatly appreciate that. And we also have a lot of new people. We had a lot of new people who just found KFUO, and they like what we're doing, and they wanted to help us continue, and they decided to give a gift, and it was really nice. Actually, you got to meet new people, and you got to talk with old friends. And it was really wonderful. And I especially love all the stories that people tell us about how KFUO has affected them or affected someone they know, how their grandparents used to have it on when they were little and they would hear it every day when their grandparents would babysit them, or people who would call us and tell us that, you know, they were just switching the stations, and they found KFUO and heard a program, and they thought it was great, and they kept listening, and and slowly it just became their routine, and it's really interesting to hear all the stories and how it has affected people.
We have just a few seconds left, but you were the one who, you're great. You were the one who keeps the numbers updated on the screen in here, what the grand total is. What was it like? We had set a goal of 150,000. What was it like at that, what, the last, what, 5 minutes, I think it was, of the program to kick that over?
It was really encouraging because we had the gift from the church and we were still a little bit short from the 150,000 that we had set our goal for. And we kind of asked people, help us reach this goal. And the Lord really provided, and he gave us wonderful supporters. We are truly blessed to have all the supporters. They really called in and helped us reach that goal, and we met it by $30, I believe.
And we still have gifts coming in, and we want people to know that they can continue to send their Share-a-thon gifts either in the mail, or they can call Mary or myself, and we will be happy to write up a pledge for them.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
All right, KFUO.org. There's the Give Now button, or real quickly, a phone number.
For Mary Schmidt, it's 314-996-1518.
That's good.
Very good. And Kip, you got to be a part of Share-a-thon this year. Did you have fun with it?
Yeah, except it blew the heck out of my diet. I mean, we had all these wonderful pastries and donuts and munchies
around. Oh, Bakery. My goodness, we have to thank them over and over for all those delicious pastries.
Well, thank you all for your hard work on Share-a-thon. Thanks to the many listeners who called in and pledged their support. It was an outstanding time. I'm not going to talk about how many cookies I ate.